For the week of April 23rd, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 363, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Stuyvesant Town, I'm Michael Giltz.
Why are you in Stuyvesant Town and why is that significant?
That's just where I'm at. I'm in Stuytown here in New York City. I'm house sitting for a friend who's in Italy, sunny, beautiful Italy. And I'm here in dreary New York with lots of tree pollen, so my nose is stuffed up.
Okay, so now we should say that Stuyvesant Town is not like you're in upstate New York. New York these days, every two blocks has its own little neighborhood name. You're Dumbo.
Nolita.
Yeah, exactly.
Fidi, Fidi for the financial district, you name it. So I'm in Stuytown, which has had that name for quite a while. It's around the teens on First Avenue.
Okay, and what separates it from the rest of New York City?
Well, it's like literally, you know, a complex, a development, an area. So it's, you know, there's multiple buildings, all of the same type in a plot of land. So it's very specific neighborhood. Yeah.
You're in the projects, basically.
Not exactly.
Okay. Well, you know, Michael, one thing I noticed when I was going over our notes for this week's show was that it's a feast or famine with us. You know, the last two shows, of course, it's been 2 weeks per show, and we've had a lot to cover, and we had a guest, and we went really long because there was so much news. This week, absolutely nothing happened.
Not except the firing of Bill O'Reilly and all sorts of exciting things. What will we talk about this week?
Well, on this week's show, we did find a few things to talk about. We'll talk about new release dates for U.S. movies in China and why none of them, absolutely none of them, star Richard Gere. During our book filter segment, Michael, you're going to tell us about the mad bomber who stalked New York City for decades, maybe even in Stuytown, and he stalked New York until the police reached out to a psychiatrist in the 1950s. I'm actually interested in hearing this story. On Inside Baseball, we'll talk about Bill O'Reilly's firing and how it set off a game of musical chairs at Fox News, and it has all Fox News' competitors licking their chops. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We pull our info from ComScore. We have a link to them in our show notes. And then we go to Box Office Profit and Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, you name it. And the number one movie around the world is, of course, The Fate of the Furious. In North America, it's a disaster. If all you looked at North America, you'd hear, oh, not good news. The Fate of the Furious opened 40% lower than the last Fast and the Furious movie, you know, 100 million rather than 140 million. This weekend had a really big drop in North America. So boy, oh boy, this movie's not doing well. Except this movie is really a worldwide phenomenon. It made $200 million this weekend. It's at $900 million worldwide. Sure, it's made $160 million in North America, but it's made $750 million overseas. So this movie is tearing it up.
Yeah, I would really hate to have a $1 billion bomb. I'll take it.
Oh, I thought you meant the budget. You're like, no, yeah, that would be bad. But yes, no, yeah, it's, you can't make a movie, you know, it's an expensive movie, $250 million it cost to make. So it needed to make $750 million just to sort of look like it was going to get into the black. It did that overseas. Now, mind you, overseas, you get less at the box office. You get like maybe, you think out of that $740 million, $750 million, they're going to get $300 million? I mean, 40%, 35%? What could they expect?
They could definitely expect 30, 35%, maybe even as much as 40%. Certainly, they're not going to get that from China. They'll probably get it roughly 25%. But then in other territories, you'll get 45% in some territories. And with a movie, by the way, like Fast and Furious, you can definitely negotiate higher terms because you know it's going to be a success. If you're an exhibitor, you want it. So you're willing to pay higher terms. So
on the other hand, China is the place where they have made the most money.
Right. And there is no negotiation there. It's top at the top rate right now. You're getting 25%.
So the Fate of the Furious is at $900 million. It's going to hit $1 billion probably next week. At number two around the world is The Boss Baby, Alec Baldwin. $42 million for that animated movie, $360 million worldwide.
Now, I'd just like to point out both with Boss Baby and Fate of the Furious. Okay, you'd think an animated film, it should be up to $600 million already if it's a successful film. Well, Look, it probably will be, you know, $400, $425 million at least worldwide. And there are certain terms that kind of fall into place in ancillary markets, specifically with cable and premium cable, of how much those networks and television channels will pay based on the domestic gross and the worldwide gross. So the higher you can get theatrically, well, guess what? All of your ancillary revenue kind of falls into line after that.
Okay, but it's a family film and it's animated, and those play really well and prove quite valuable as a catalog item. And it only cost $125 million to make. So by the end of next weekend, this movie will be easily, we can say, profitable just from its theatrical distribution alone.
Absolutely.
And let's not take for granted these movies making $1 billion. The Fate of the Furious is going to do that. So has Beauty and the Beast. $32 million over the weekend. $1.1 billion worldwide. Hardly a given. Disney's most valuable property in a way. Its crown jewel, the animated version of Beauty and the Beast, turned into a live-action film. Could have been a disaster. A massive worldwide success.
Now, let's take that for example. Domestic gross of $471 million so far, right? And it made this weekend $9.9 million. So it's still going, maybe not as strong as when it opened, but it's still going pretty well. Okay, if you look at that, and it used to be that an HBO or a TNT, or, all of these stations would take about 25%. That would be the licensing fee, 25% of domestic box office. I don't know how closely that is to today's terms, but even
they might have a top. They might have a top too. They might say, "All right, 25% until we reach this amount, and then we're done."
Right. But you look at that and you go, "Okay, if it is anywhere near that, you're talking about at least $100 million to license that between premium and basic cable."
And that's getting you close to your $160 million budget.
That's correct.
At number four around the world is Smurfs, The Lost Village, $26 million over the weekend, $130 million worldwide. At number five, Old Guys Having Fun, It's Going in Style, another $10 million over the weekend and $50 million worldwide. At number six, here's our first international film. It's Mr. Pride versus Miss Prejudice. It's a Chinese romantic comedy based on the novel by Mai Mai Mao, I assume. That it has some playoff of the Jane Austen novel, though from the description, it doesn't sound like it particularly. But $7 million over the weekend. I guess it opened on Wednesday or Thursday because its total is $9.4 million. That's in China alone. I don't know what the budget is, but a pretty good start and a clever title for that movie. And number seven is Unforgettable. This is a film, one of the rare films directed by a woman, Denise Dinovi. It stars Rosario Dawson and Katherine Heigl. Heigl, of course, has had a checkered box office history. It made $6.5 million on its opening weekend. Not a great launch, but it's not an expensive movie. The budget is about $12 million, so it'll probably be okay when all is said and done, but not a very good start.
And if that name, Denise Dinovi, sounds familiar, it's because she has spent a career producing movies.
That's right. She's a very successful producer.
Yes, mostly of, I want to say, well, movies like Crazy Stupid Love, I believe, was one of her movies, and a lot of Tim Burton movies. So The Nightmare Before Christmas, Batman Returns, Edward Scissorhands, that's how you would recognize that name.
That's right. Number eight, you might recognize this name. It's Disney Nature. It's a nature-branded documentary arm for Disney films. Disney has a long history of making documentary films and nature-based movies. They aired on The Wonderful World of Disney. They aired in movie theaters. They've been doing this a long time, and they've started an annual tradition about 8 or 9 years ago of releasing a nature documentary on Earth Day, or at least the weekend around that. Born in China is their latest. They have seemed to have ratcheted down the budgets on these movies. The last few that I saw the budget on, it was about $5 million. I'm not sure how you make them that inexpensively, but we're going to have to guess maybe that's about what this one costs. It made $5 million this weekend. It's at $15 million worldwide. And these are just sort of this is a particularly well-reviewed one. And I think that just like family films, they're pretty profitable when it comes to being a catalog item.
Every review I read or heard about this movie said it is absolutely stunning to look at. However, listening to it, it's just, they anthropomorphize all of the animals and they give their names. And
No. They
said it's almost, I actually both read and heard a review of this where both critics said the same thing. Go see the movie, bring your iPod or your iPhone and put earbuds in and listen to something else because it's beautiful to look at and horrible to listen to.
Oh, wow. That's too bad. And number nine is Ghost in the Shell, starring Scarlett Johansson. $4.6 million over the weekend, $160 million worldwide. Jumping down, looking for some new information. What have we got? We still haven't learned about A Chinese Odyssey Part 2, Cinderella. I assume that's a reissue of the 1990s movie, but I don't know. It's at $27 million worldwide. The Met released a live opera event, Eugene Onegin. That made $2.8 million in seven territories. And here's a fun movie from Russia. It's called The Kitchen, Mortal Kombat. It's not a spinoff of Mortal Kombat involving food. It's a Russian comedy about chefs competing somehow at the Sochi Olympics for supremacy. Not a great opening weekend, $2.3 million, though I don't know the budget of the movie.
Well, now, a couple things regarding The Met. Okay, it made $2.8 million, $1.3 in the United States and $1.5 overseas in those seven territories. That was really with one showing. Now, granted, the showing costs more money. So it's a $20, $25 ticket. If you're lucky, you might have gotten it at $15 here in the United States. So it does have a higher ticket price, but that's with one showing only. So that's pretty impressive.
Absolutely. It's they've created the live event series. People like it. They go around. You can't get to New York. You can't see the opera. It's the next best thing.
Well, and before people write in and tell me the terms for licensing feature films, theatrical feature films on a premium or basic cable shows aren't 25% anymore, I do realize that there are output deals now where all of that, those terms are negotiated up front, no matter how much the film makes.
So they lock in a price rather than make it pegged to the box office.
Correct. Yeah. And actually that's one way that you actually get funding is you have an output deal. A production company like a DreamWorks or a Warner Brothers will have an output deal with, say, HBO and TNT. Right. And then you go and you get your financing, loans and bridge financing based on that.
Yeah. You have a guaranteed revenue stream.
Correct.
All right. Well, every day we get emails and press releases and stories about release dates. Oh, this movie has announced a release date. That movie has announced a release date. I ignore 90% of them, but we have exceptions. One is Avatar because its release date keeps changing. And two is China. When China announces a Hollywood movie is coming to China, we like to pay attention to that because that's about to become the biggest box office in the world. First, Avatar.
Well, when they announce something like this, look, Avatar was a big movie, so why not have a big announcement around it? In fact, why mention just one Avatar when you can mention four of them?
That's right. They've pushed back the release date. Now they're firm. Now this is when they're going to come out. From, 2016 and 2018? Now we're at 2020. They say the first new Avatar film will come out in 2020. That's the same year as a Star Wars. That's the same year as the last Star Wars film. You remember those like nine Star Wars movies they mapped out? Han Solo, young Han Solo movie. Boba Fett. Or they don't even know what some of these movies are. The three trilogy movies. The spinoffs like Rogue One. They announced like nine movies in a row from Disney in the Star Wars franchise. The last one comes out in 2020. That's when the first new Avatar movie comes out. So they will finally be head-to-head at Christmas time. That's two movies that will almost certainly make $1 billion at the box office, each of them. So that's kind of amazing. And then the next one comes out in 2021. And then the next one comes out not in 2022, but 3 years later in 2024. And then the fourth and final sequel in this whole five movie extravaganza comes out in 2025. That means that the Avatar theme park will open up in Disney World years before the movie comes out.
That is true.
That means there will be a 3-year gap in 21 to 2024, which I don't understand. So what's going on here?
Well, a couple things. First off, I'd like to point out that the original film, Avatar, was released in 2009. So there will be an 11-year gap in between the first film and the second film. That's a pretty large gap. Now, James Cameron loves his technology, right? And he's always trying to push the technology. So a couple things happen. One, I think he's trying to figure some technology stuff out for numbers 2 and 3. Obviously, Avatar 2 and Avatar 3 are being shot together because they're releasing them a year apart, 20 and 21. 4 and 5 are probably also being shot together, or at least the plan is to shoot them together, because they are being released a year apart, 2024 and 2025. So I think in part, it's you can't shoot four movies at once. That might be their thinking, especially from an actor's standpoint. You might have to go off and do other things, although, you know, it's not impossible. I think Cameron is waiting for some technology to catch up with his imagination for 2024 and 2025. But I also think the studio is saying, hey, let's see how 2020 and 2021 do, and then we can really make a decision on 24 and 25.
Ooh, I don't know about that. That I don't buy. I bought everything except the idea that the studio is hedging their bets and doesn't want to commit to four films at once. Because they're going to have to commit to starting filming and doing stuff for 2024, probably before 2020 hits, don't you think?
Well, you'd think that.
Or as it hits.
Yeah, pretty much as the film is released in 2020, they will have some indication in that year, 2020 to 2021, what needs, you know, where those films are going, how they're doing financially and theatrically and critically, and what's working and what's not working, certainly. So they can actually rejigger whatever they want to, you know.
I think this is all his doing. I buy you when you say, hey, the actors, they have other commitments, or not really necessarily, but, you know, hey, doing four movies in a row is a really long time commitment, and maybe they want to give them a break. They want to let technology catch up or see what new toys they have. That makes sense to me. I buy everything except the idea that the studio told Cameron, no, we don't want to do four in a row. Let's just wait. We'll look and see what's happening.
For me, that is just one of the many things that could be causing the 3-year gap.
Okay. I buy the other reasons, but that one I don't. But we can bet that when they do come out, they'll probably come out in China day and date.
Yes.
You know, China is probably going to want to see them day and date. They're certainly, you know, it's a big market. They loved Avatar. They're going to want to see them. And China has announced some upcoming films. They've announced Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales. That will come out on May 26th. Wonder Woman comes out June 2nd, and Transformers comes out on June 23rd. Most of these are day and date or very much close to it, you know, as much as. That's not what the phrase is that I want. As good as day and date. That's what they are. But what's notable here is that they are pretty much saying these in advance. This is April. It doesn't seem that much in advance, but they've given them a month's warning on Pirates and almost 2 months warning on Transformers. And that lets studios do something they haven't been able to do for a while with Chinese movies. And what's that?
Market?
Exactly, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, it's not uncommon where you have advance notice. Certainly everybody knew that Spider-Man was going up against the last Batman, you know, so there was, you know.
In China?
Yes, that's exactly
Oh, yeah, but how long did they know in advance?
Oh, they knew pretty far in advance because, of course, there was that no-go zone. There was the blackout in the summer, and they said, well, you can't release during the summer, but when the blackout is lifted, we'll let you release Spider-Man, at the same time as you release Batman.
But it does seem like they're being more accommodating and recognizing, hey, the studios want to be able to market their films. We want to give them the opportunity to do that because it's better for the exhibitors and everybody.
That is correct. Oh, and by the way, didn't Disney open a little theme park in Shanghai that, you know, certainly Pirates of the Caribbean is a ride there and could.
Yeah, I wonder what the audience figures are for that, the attendance.
I have no idea, but you look at that and you look at Transformers, and these are big budget movies, which is exactly what China wants. They always said, please send us your movies, provided they are tentpole films.
They're not releing, you know, art house movies, that's
no.
For sure. All right. So we got a bunch of movies announced for China. None of them star Richard Gere. And Richard Gere says, that's no surprise. I support Tibet. I am persona non grata in China. And I've been having trouble for years now. He's been making movies. They've become smaller. It might have just been the usual career trajectory of a big star, you know, making smaller roles or more independent films to follow your heart and your art. You know, you're not making the big romantic comedies like you were when you were 30 and 40. But he says it's also because he's pro-Tibet, and China doesn't like him, and he's had directors or producers or people say, hey, we can't make this movie with you because we can't get financing if we're going to not be able to release it in China.
Right.
You know, if you starring, China's not going to show it, therefore we're losing out on the second biggest market in the world, and we can't do that.
Well, and this all, well, I guess you could say it started, but certainly the highest profile event where Richard Gere spoke out on Tibet, and of course China is occupying Tibet. By the way, this story comes from The Hollywood Reporter. He gave an interview to The Hollywood Reporter, which is where all of this information comes from. In 1993, at the Oscars, Richard Gere infamously, rather than say
he's,
his.
He's had decades of speaking out in support of Tibet and the Dalai Lama. Yes, that's we all know that.
Right, but it really, you know, I don't want to say kicked off, but certainly that was a high profile moment, and everybody points to that, including himself, by the way. But yeah,
and activism for decades since then. That's absolutely. Event that did it. It's one event of many. It's
absolutely.
Just,
yeah. I mean, he has not shut up since then. That's for sure.
I say shut up, speaking out for the human rights of people in Tibet.
Well, yeah, I guess you could
shut up is not the right word to use there.
Yeah. Cause it has, yes. I don't mean, I feel like Sean Spicer right now.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Thank God you don't look like it.
Oh, but I'm
so, yeah. So he said, so we believe him. I mean, obviously, you know, he's not the hot mega star he was before. You suggested off the air, perhaps, well, you know, if you need to tell him you're not going to cast him in a movie, well, just tell him, you know, it's China. Blame it on China rather than saying, yeah, we want somebody younger.
We don't want to hurt his feelings. And, oh, by the way, he's represented by somebody who we actually, you know, an agent that we need to please. So we'll tell both of them that it's not us. It's China. If China doesn't want you, so we can't cast you. I don't know
so
how true
did,
that is.
He
that
did
is,
say he was about to make a movie like 2 weeks away from production beginning with a Chinese director. And the director said, hey, I can't do this because I'll never be allowed to leave China again if I make a movie with you. And that's believable.
Well, not only would the director not be able to leave again, but his family would never be allowed to leave the country either. So and Richard Gere said, look, I totally understand that. I speak out on Tibet, and I understand that I'm a public figure who speaks out on Tibet, and therefore China doesn't like me because of it, and I can understand why a director might have a little bit of a problem, especially if he's Chinese himself.
Exactly. Well, so there you go. Now the silver lining is that, as Hollywood Reporter puts it, he's making smaller, more interesting movies, perhaps, than he might have as a big Hollywood star, and he's getting some good reviews. He's making some of the, you know, The Dinner is a film that people are looking forward to. It's based on a famous French novel, and Norman is another movie that he's getting some good reviews for, playing a hustler, an Israeli hustler. You know, maybe there will be a happy ending.
I actually want to see Norman now because Joseph Seder actually directed it, and I happen to like his movies.
Oh, he's a very good director.
Yes, an Israeli director.
And, you know, it's an exciting story. Maybe someday Richard Gere will publish his memoirs, and we can all learn the backstory of Pretty Woman and his support for the Dalai Lama and Tibet and the whole ups and downs of a fascinating career.
Oh, wait. If you're talking about books, then it must be time for our Book Filter segment. Book Filter is a book lover's best friend, and every week, Michael, you pick a couple of books that are ready to be optioned or that Hollywood should be reading or looking out for, maybe adapting, or books that, frankly, our listeners should know about and might want to read. What are your selections this week, Michael? I hope it's only one.
It's not. It's fish in a barrel. You know, I've got your easy pick and I've got your trickier pick. I've got your easy pick of books that are easy to turn into a property, and I've got the more Moneyball type book where you go, how are you going to turn that into a movie? The easy picks are books like Law and Disorder, The Chaotic Birth of the NYPD, which is a history book about the birth of the NYPD, which is kind of fascinating and fun, crazy early chronicles of that group. I've seen mystery books set in this era when the NYPD was being birthed. It's interesting. It's fun. There's a novel, A Single Spy, which is about a Russian who looks very similar to this young German kid right around World War II. And he's a ne'er-do-well, and he's trapped by the government, and he's forced to choose. And they offer him the choice to become a spy and pretend to be this other kid who's gone missing and is now 10 years later. So he's a young man grown up, and he has to go back to Nazi Germany and pretend to be this German kid who's a member of the Nazi elite and part of that world, and insinuate himself into that world and become a spy. So he's a communist being a spy in Nazi Germany.
Wait a second. So, I need to make a note here. German adaptation of The Americans.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, this guy is not going to this movie's not going to get made in America.
Yeah,
you got
exactly.
A communist hero in Nazi Germany. Not going to happen. But my pick for the big book of the week is Incendiary. This is a nonfiction book as well. It's by Michael Cannell, who's written for The New Yorker and The New York Times and other people like that. New York Times Magazine, Sports Illustrated, Time, Newsweek. He's got a high profile. And this book is a lot of fun. It's set in 1950s New York, and it reminds us about this mad bomber, this guy who stalked the city for decades. He left bombs at Penn Station and Grand Central and Radio City Music Hall. It was everywhere. Nobody was safe from this crazy guy. And it went on for years and years and years until finally, in desperation, the police turned to like this little known psychiatrist who, working with them and looking at the crime scene and the clues, developed a profile of the criminal. He specialized in the criminal mind, and he developed a profile of the criminal, including the cut of his coat. And it was like the first act of profiling, and it helped birth the modern idea of learning about the person based on clues from the notes that they leave and the things that they do. Who is this person? What kind of person are we looking for? What might they be like? And that birth of criminal profiling happened right here. It's a fascinating story. If it's not, you know, optioned already, I'll eat my shirt.
Well, wait a second. Don't they have TV shows like that, like The Mentalist and
this is the
Medium?
First one. This is the, well, The Mentalist is not a profiler. The Mentalist uses, you know, is a good quick character study. But yeah, no, this is the first profiler, and it's real life, and it's a true story. What do you mean?
All right, I'm just saying. I'm just trying
saying to... what? That their profiling continues up to today? Yes, of course. That's why learning about the first story. And by the way, a mad bomber setting off bombs in New York City. Who remembers that happened? Nobody.
Nobody. Yeah, well, right. Well, I guess it depends on what kind of bombs you're talking about and the time frame.
Those are the easy books. The difficult book is called The Golden Passport. This is the hot book of the week. It's a nonfiction book about the history of Harvard Business School. Turn that into a movie or a miniseries. But it's a fascinating book. It's getting great reviews. And it posits that the Harvard Business School, while wildly influential and successful, has failed at its own stated mission to create graduates who go on into business to solve problems and do it, quote, in a socially constructive way. Are they bettering society by what they do? And this book says, dear God, no. All they do is look for quarterly profits, and they make a lot of money, but they are destroying society. So it's a red-hot book in the Ivy League. It's a red-hot book in the business world, The Golden Passport. It's fascinating. It's interesting, getting great reviews. I'm looking forward to reading it. And if you can turn that into a movie, you've really done a good job.
How about a movie about like a young kid who goes to Harvard, but then kind of doesn't really like it there, or, you know, he finds that, you know, work else. Well, he finds that his attention is in other areas. So he leaves Harvard, goes to Silicon Valley and starts a website that's a social network. So you wanted to talk about socially constructive ways. Well, he starts a website that is a...
Exactly. Turning that into a movie was tricky.
Yes. And they did a fairly decent job, I'd say.
I didn't love it, but I liked it and respected it.
Well,
and certainly all the attention and good success it had and Oscar nominations, it was a big deal.
Oh, wait. Whoa. You just said the two magic words, Oscar and success. Also, you said big deal, which means it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, well, last week we discussed Asia Kate Dillon of the TV show Billionaires. Or no, it's not Billionaires, it's Billions, isn't it?
Billions, I beg your pardon.
Yeah, well, Asia Kate Dillon identifies as gender non-binary and chose to submit his work for Emmy consideration under actor, since that word can be gender non-specific. We speculated as to when an award show would ditch gender categories altogether, and lo and behold, the MTV Movie Awards have done precisely that.
We should have picked someone cool like that to do it, you
exactly.
know, someone hip and young and trendy. That was stupid of us.
Well, so here's how it goes. For example, best actor in a TV show included all in one competition, all the actors and actresses, Donald Glover of Atlanta, Emilia Clarke of Game of Thrones, Gina Rodriguez of Jane the Virgin, Jeffrey Dean Morgan of The Walking Dead, Mandy Moore of This Is Us, and Millie Bobby Brown of Stranger Things. That wasn't so hard, was it? Big deal or big whoop?
Well, this is why we need to do the show every day, since that came out like hours after we had our podcast up and running. So it was a bummer. You know, we just missed the deadline on that one. But I think it's very well intended. I think it's even inevitable, as we discussed last week. But the problem is, what will this do in practical terms? Will this limit visibility and wins for women and people of color and people of different genders or people who don't identify as, you know, male or female? It's clearly a good idea. It's clearly the wave of the future. But, you know, what are you going to do? You're going to increase visibility by having categories for people of color, or increase visibility by having a trans category? You know, you want them to win, be nominated for the main award and win. But if you eliminate Best Actress, what is the practical result? Will there be fewer women winning awards, or fewer people who are not identifying as male winning the top award? That's the possibility, at least in the short term. So it's good. It's inevitable, but it may have some unfortunate consequences, at least early on.
Yeah, and I don't, I'm not a big proponent of combining these two categories. I think the roles that each gender plays.
What? A straight white male is not a proponent of.
Well, no, I'm just saying that I honestly think that you're not comparing apples to oranges. That's, I'm not going that far. I'm saying that you're kind of trying to compare two different types of apples and trying to decide which one is best. Well, it really depends on what you're making.
I don't know what you're talking about. You're saying who gave the best performance as a lead actor in a lead actor in a drama? Why separate them by gender when there are going to be people who don't identify as male or female, and or you know, why do that? What's the benefit to that? What's hard?
I think the type
the best comic performance on TV is it Julia Louis-Dreyfus in Veep, or is it one of the guys from Big Bang Theory? Is that so hard to compare? You think the fact that she has breasts make her funnier or less funny? No. So who gave the best comic performance? Was it Julia Louis-Dreyfus or please name the guy from Big Bang Theory? I can't think of his name.
Oh my gosh. You mean Jim Parsons, you mean?
Yeah. I'm just saying. All right. So who's funnier? Who gave the better performance this season? Compare them. Is it? Can you not compare them? Do you say, oh my God, I can't. She's got breasts.
No, I'm saying that in that case, you're actually a lot closer. But trying to compare a performance by Gina Rodriguez of Jane the Virgin to Emilia Clarke of Game of Thrones, one is a comedy, one is a drama.
Well, but that's now you're talking about a different issue, aren't you? You're talking about drama. This is drama, by the way.
They're all in this.
I mean, you're talking about them not making the distinction between drama and comedy. So you're saying who gave the best performance at the Oscars? They don't break it down by drama and comedy, which is why comics often get overlooked.
That is true. They always get overlooked.
But again, that's a different issue. TV has drama and comedy categories at the Emmys. Do you have a problem saying who's better? You're raising a different issue. The issue is gender. Should there be male and female categories for acting in a comedy? Or do you feel like you can't compare Julia Louis-Dreyfus versus Jim Parsons and decide who gave the funniest performance?
I think in that particular example, you probably
that
could.
That is the only example we're talking about. Forget the MTV Movie Awards. The question is gender categories, not drama, comedy, or any other distinction, whether the Oscars should have drama versus comedy or leave it like they have it. The question is, should you have categories for people in gender? That is the question on the table.
Yes, I think you should, and I will.
Why?
I will.
You
point
just said you shouldn't. Do you have best album by a chick? No. You don't. You have best album of the year, period.
Wait, you don't
have
best female
country
vocalist?
Album by a chick? No, you don't. You have best country album, period. Sometimes they go have smaller categories like duo, group versus solo. Sometimes they do have best singer, male, female. I think that'll go by the wayside. But focus on best album. What's the best album of the year? Does it matter whether it's Adele or Drake? Can you not compare their albums?
So I don't necessarily see there being a best female movie of the year or best male movie of the year, which is what you're comparing.
Dramatic performance versus comedy.
I guess, and we could talk about this forever, so we should probably move on. But you're saying album of the year, which I would liken to best picture, okay, rather than best female pop
Except
vocal
album
performance.
Of the year is an artist. It's not right. Okay, again, I ask you, best comedy performance on TV. Best lead performance in a comedy. Do you have any problem? Do you find it weird to say who's better, Julia Louis-Dreyfus or Jim Parsons? Or do you find that, no, I make that decision. That seems perfectly normal to me. It's suddenly it's a new world. Once you make the change, something that seems strange or what? You're not going to separate them by gender? Suddenly you don't even think twice about it. Julia Louis-Dreyfus versus Jim Parsons. Do you think that's weird or unfair or strange? Or can you see that and
in
go, yeah,
comedy,
that makes sense.
In comedy, it might be a lot easier than, say,
or drama, or okay, the, well, the lead then of Scandal versus the lead of Walking Dead. Who cares?
Who would you have selected this year for, let's go back to the Oscars.
I would select whoever was better.
Okay, but you're comparing totally different roles.
I would say some years Meryl Streep is better for Sophie's Choice versus somebody else in whatever was competing against Sophie's Choice. I think she gave a better performance than Kevin Klein. They were maybe both leads. I'd say she was better.
Well, here's what I would like to do. I would like to throw it out to our listeners and tell us what you think about this, quite honestly. I am genuinely interested to know what our listeners think about this particular issue. You can do that by writing to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also reach out on Twitter. @showbizsandbox is our handle. You can find us on Facebook. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up. You can like it and send us messages there. And we do respond and we do play the voicemails and read the emails at the end of each show when we receive them. So please, I am genuinely interested to know what everybody thinks about this particular issue.
And what do you think of subtitling?
I would tell you, but I'd have to do it in a different language so that you could then translate it for our listeners. But then I would have to sue you for copyright infringement.
Keep going.
Here's the thing, Michael. Is fair use a little like porn? That's my question. And I know you're thinking, wait, you were just talking about subtitles. But porn is the kind of thing, you know it when you see it, right? Apparently not. A Dutch court ruled that crowdsourced subtitling is in fact copyright infringement. A Dutch group called the Free Subtitles Foundation actually initiated the lawsuit, hoping to set a precedent, allowing people who weren't profiting but simply wanted to make movies and TV shows more accessible via subtitles. The judge said it may be noble what they're doing, but without permission, it's still copyright infringement. On the other hand, Netflix and YouTube are encouraging the crowdsourcing of subtitles. So, very confusing, but big deal or big whoop.
I guess it's a big whoop. If we have to see if it goes up, I guess, to the EU court, if that's where it would go next, if it got appealed or something like that, whether that's possible. It does seem like another example of sort of the letter of the law, but confusing the spirit of the law. And it seems to me perfectly fair use to just provide subtitling. You know, that does not seem a thing that damages or hurts the copyright holder in any way.
Okay, a couple things here. I'm going to start off with, I love how we, you know, kind of had a tie between porn and copyright infringement. Okay, so let's start there. But secondly, I would, on a serious note, like to point out that, you know, one of the reasons the court may have ruled, although I haven't read the ruling, one of the reasons they may have ruled that it was copyright infringement and why certain content owners have fought this is because some of those subtitles wind up on websites where people download them and tie them to stolen content.
Right. This group particularly specifically avoided that and was using cases where they weren't doing that.
Right.
And they were saying that Breen, the group that they sued that was doing these takedown notices on them, was targeting them as opposed to people who were simply, that's a separate issue, stealing movies. This is not the issue at hand. And they made sure they had a case where that was not the issue at hand. And therefore, that was not part of the ruling.
And I know that, you know, speaking of subtitles, when it comes to packaging and mastering content, the fact that timed text, which is the file that actually says, okay, at, 1 hour, 20 minutes and 33 seconds, please put up the following subtitle because the character is saying XYZ and we need to put that on screen. That is that is protected. That file is, you know, encrypted and is copywritten. So,
well, if the subtitle was there, they wouldn't need to create it.
Good point.
Yeah. No. And of course, there's 100 languages. So, yeah, you may have English, French and Spanish, but there's 100 languages in the world. If not, I'm sure there's more. So, you know, there's an endless demand that they cannot practically meet. And if people are willing to provide it open source, crowdsourcing it for free as a service, why you'd go after that, I don't know.
Well, I think Hollywood is moving to the Southern Hemisphere. You know why?
Why?
Winter is coming. And by winter, we mean the end of the HBO series Game of Thrones in 2018. Ever since it became huge, everyone has been searching for the next big TV fantasy franchise. The Sword of Shannara, The Magicians, and numerous other fantasy properties have made the leap, but not quite set the world on fire. Now, one of the best fantasy properties around is moving forward. The Wheel of Time is a 14-novel series, very much in the vein of Lord of the Rings. Penned mostly by Robert Jordan, it began as a planned 6 volumes, but kept expanding and expanding and expanding until Jordan died and the last of the 14 books finally came out with a co-author. These are epic books. They're big. And unlike Game of Thrones, get this, they already have a beginning, a middle, and you're really going to believe, you know, you're not going to really understand this, Michael. It's called an ending. These books have an ending, unlike Game of Thrones. Sony is producing, and after an epic legal battle over rights, all the problems are cleared up and it's moving forward with key behind the scenes talent already in place. Now all they need to do is decide who will play our hero dubbed the Dragon Reborn. By the way, I'm available. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. It's a great property. It'd be fascinating to know what they do with it, but it's so huge. I just can't even imagine it. Even with all the epic scope of TV that we have now, it's a big, big series. So we'll have to see.
Well, I would like to let Sony know that unlike the actors on Avatars 2, 3, 4, and 5, who obviously did not want to be gone for 5 years to shoot all these movies, I am more than happy to be gone for 14 years so that you can make 14 straight movies that I will star in.
You're a good man.
Okay, well, now when I do star in those movies, all 14 of them, I will need to be a member of a union. Now, the WGA is moving closer and closer to a strike in May. We talked about that on the previous two episodes. Meanwhile, SAG-AFTRA, the union representing performers, has a new election coming in June, and the campaigning is already underway. And by campaigning, we mean letters threatening legal action. One group that includes actor Ed Asner, among many others, has been out for, they've been out of power since 2009. They have sued in court several times and would love to roll back the merger of SAG and AFTRA, the two unions that merged. They shared a letter digging up numerous previous complaints and threatening to file a lawsuit if their concerns aren't met. The other faction, led by Gabriel Carteres, and if that name sounds familiar, Beverly Hills 90210, she says, look, guys, grow up. We've heard it all before. Your past lawsuits failed, and so will this. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop. There doesn't seem to be anything new here, so I'm not sure what they think they're going to accomplish by this. I don't even think it's a very good way to win people to your cause, but we'll have to see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's like, oh, Ed Asner and his contingent is suing SAG again. Well, in this case, SAG-AFTRA again.
Yeah.
The streaming service Netflix, which will have you, if you'd like, write their subtitles for them. They fell modestly short of their quarterly subscriber projections, at least, to their count. That left them at 98.7 million subscribers worldwide, a smidge shy of 100 million, but that was enough to send their stock down modestly the day after it was announced. They continue to show no interest in sports, but Netflix doubled down on stand-up comedy. Adam Sandler and other original long-form content like A Series of Unfortunate Events. The proof?
Which you're watching and liking, right?
Yes, I actually have watched like two episodes and I do like it. The proof that all of what I just said is absolutely true? In 2017, they'll be spending more than $1 billion, not on content, okay, but on marketing alone. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop that they fell modestly short of their projection. You know, it's a game that they play where you want to announce a really good projection, but you want to make sure you can match it. But you want to make sure that the level you set is not so low that people go, oh, big deal, your projection was too low to begin with. I mean, it's just a little game. Why they can't all just say, here's what happened, rather than making a game out of predicting what will happen, boggles my mind.
Well, they call that the stock market, and that's pretty much how that works. You basically say, hey, we think we're going to make a dollar, and oh, sorry, we only made 75 cents. All of those who bet on
Stock market doesn't have to work that way. It can work to say, oh, it used to be, here was our quarterly profits. And people say, oh, okay, there you go. That's good. Good job. Rather than having to predict in advance what your quarterly profits will in a way that's reasonable to get and yet not so high that it, not so low. You know, that's the game that I object to.
Right. Well, I think a lot of people object to that whole game, but that's kind of what it's become. What I love about this story, and it's related, though not entirely tied to it, is the headline from The Verge, which reads, Netflix accuses its users of watching 500 million hours of Adam Sandler films. I love that headline. Netflix accuses its users of watching Adam Sandler films. If that's
sounds
true.
Like the onion.
Exactly. But first of all, 500 million hours of Adam Sandler films, given the number of people who are subscribed to Netflix, is not that much, okay?
Yeah, it is. That means every single one of them watched 2.5 movies by Adam Sandler.
Which is, again, I would go not that much. If they all watched Hotel Transylvania, that would be it.
What? No, it wouldn't be.
Well,
if they all watched Hotel Transylvania, 100 million people, that'd be 200 million hours. Or less than that. It's probably not even a 2-hour movie. They'd have to watch it twice and then half again.
Well, I meant the series. There's two movies for Hotel Transylvania. That's kind of what I meant. Do the math on that. Do the math on that. That's like 3 hours and times two. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Write into us and tell us how poor my math was. Now, the Tony Awards were floundering around, but now they found their host. It's Tony winner Kevin Spacey, a regular on the boards in the U.S., the successful artistic director of the Young Vic in the U.K., and even the host of the Olivier Awards. The Tonys felt no one could top James Corden's splashy opening from last year, so they wanted to go in a more traditional, sober, stay-out-of-the-way sort of host. Okay, but apparently they didn't get the memo that Spacey ended the Olivier Awards by bringing in a gospel choir and belting out Bridge Over Troubled Waters. Big deal or big whoop?
I mean, he said, they asked me to do this. I really didn't want to, but, you know, I felt like I had to bring this all together. You know, it was the Bridge Project, of course, was a project that he did at the Young Vic and he was involved in with other people here in the U.S. And so he's like, I just had to. And like, when you're weary, you know, it's like, oh, my God, you know, a wallflower. He's not. If they keep a mic out of it, he just came on stage and sang New York State of Mind with Billy Joel, by the way. If they keep him away from a microphone and not singing, I will be astonished. I'll bet you $5 Kevin Spacey sings at the Tony Awards.
What's the over under on that? Is it is it higher or lower than the Netflix subscriber?
Maybe he won't. But because it's not as flexible to Tony's as it would be at the Olivier's somehow. But I don't know. Crazy. But he's a good choice for a host. He's smart. He's good on his feet. He's done it before, you know, in the UK, so he's got some practice. So I think he's a fine choice.
Well, I would say you all should, I became Southern all of a sudden. Everybody should go YouTube that performance of Bridge Over Troubled Water at the Olivier Awards. It's a little awkward. So, yeah, I agree with you. Another day, Michael, another Marvel movie snags hip directors to give their franchise some cachet. This time, it's directing duo Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck of Half Nelson fame, the team behind that acclaimed little 2006 indie, with a breakout performance from one Ryan Gosling, has now been tapped to helm Captain Marvel. The film will star Oscar winner Brie Larson as Carol Danvers, one of Marvel's most iconic female characters, if not their biggest, also known as Miss Marvel, so you know she's got her feminist credentials. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop, but it's just all weird and kind of upsetting. First of all, it was weird because the headline said that the team behind Mississippi Grind was making the Marvel movie. I'm like, is that the one you want to mention for Boden and Fleck? Because that was not exactly a big success. I didn't even know who that meant at first. I had to look that up. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I had to look that up too, but I think maybe the reason they mentioned that is because it was their most recent film.
I understand, but why, you know, again, that points out the other odd thing about this is that typically the people that they've been snagging are like young up and comers. They've got a hip young film. They did a short and that becomes a movie, or they did a movie that, you know, did well. These are people who have sort of floundered a little bit. I love Half Nelson. I think they're talented people. That's a terrific movie with Ryan Gosling in it. They don't exactly have a ton of heat, so they are a more unusual choice for Marvel because typically they've been picking the young rising people, and these people are sort of a little at sea. And again, of course, it's yet another example of people who have no whatsoever experience in doing big, huge films. Again, some of the other people they pick are people working in the genre, like horror or doing fun special effects online on YouTube. And that makes a sense when you're going to leap to a big movie that you're in that world. These people aren't in that world at all. And this is a big character. This Ms. Marvel has been around since the 60s. She's their most important female character. It's the equivalent of their Wonder Woman. So I think they're interesting choices. I think the way it was mentioned in the press was weird. I think them choosing them is a little weird, and it is getting a little depressing that everybody with any sort of half sense of credibility gets to make a crappy Marvel movie. It would be great if they were all making good ones.
Well, you know, maybe after my starring roles in Wheel of Time and the 14 films that will come out of that, they'll let me star in one of these big movies.
Now you're going to have to read the books.
Yeah, of course, all 14 of them.
Well, start with The Eye of the World. It's only like 400 pages.
Oh, wow. Actually, that's lately, that's pretty small for me. Okay, so let's move along to other things from the past, like the TV show The X-Files, which returned after 14 years. You might remember that. Remember when that happened?
I do.
It was off the air for 14 years and 8 years since the flop feature film. It came back. The ratings dropped after the initial tune-in. The reviews were poor, and everyone seemed pretty much, you know, unhappy. But add it all up, and the show never dropped below 11 million viewers during the 6-episode run of the comeback, so to speak. So they're doing it all over again. Fox announced another 10-episode season to run during the 2017-2018 season. Gillian Anderson and David Duchovny are back on board. Heck, those two are even doing an audiobook together. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal because maybe they can do it right this time. Nobody seemed happy, and I feel like they got it off their backs. People were excited. They stuck with it, even though it was kind of confusing and a mess. And maybe now they can sort of relax and say, okay, they're going to come back. They're going to watch. Let's do this right.
Speaking of coming back, one of my favorite lines from the past week was said by Trevor Noah when he threw to commercial last Wednesday, his first commercial break. He said, unlike Bill O'Reilly, we'll be right back. What I'm trying to say is it's time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And Bill O'Reilly is what we're talking about this week.
That's right. He's been fired from Fox News. They came to an understanding. He left. They said, here, take $25 million. Please go away. He said, fine. He's back this week with a podcast. If you subscribe to his personal website, he has a podcast that you get free access to. So now everybody's going to have to subscribe to that podcast in the media so they can hear what he's going to say. But, you know, he doesn't want to go away. He doesn't want to go anywhere. He's disheartened about how it all happened. The question is, why was he fired now? The New York Times ran a story detailing information and allegations and lawsuits that we had already known about.
Which we talked about. We talked about it 2 weeks ago when this happened.
Well, we knew about it years ago when these allegations came out and when lawsuits were filed.
I mean, when the story was...
Yeah. The question is, yeah, but now he's been fired. And the question is, why was he fired? They knew about this stuff for years ago.
This sexual harassment, these claims that he, now we know he paid for, you know, he paid settlements on.
Yeah, $5 million have been paid, more than $13 million after accusing him of sexual harassment and other stuff. And Bill O'Reilly, out of his own pocket, has paid $10 million. And just like Bill Cosby and Nate Parker and other people in the public eye, at some point you say, all right, yeah, you know, one person steps forward and accuses you of something, even though philosophically we know people don't run around typically making accusations of rape or sexual harassment because you don't really benefit from doing that. Even though we it's only fair to say, well, you know, it's not in a court of law, it hasn't been proven, we have to give the benefit of the doubt. Once you've got 20 women saying Bill Cosby did something, the doubt starts, you know, starts to go on him. Bill O'Reilly, you paid out $10 million to 5 different women. That's not paying something to go away. That's you being guilty.
Well, that's the, you know, it's what we all believe to be true.
Right. You don't pay people $10 million because you're innocent. You fight them in court. You can afford lawyers for $10 million. If you're innocent, you fight them to the bitter end. He says, well, I did it for my family. It's like, no. Not 5 different women, $10 million out of your own pocket. At some point, you know, common sense has to kick in. You go, okay, he's not been found guilty in a criminal court of law, but he's pretty much, you're showing your guilt when you pay out $10 million to 5 different people. I'm sorry. So that's the fact. But nonetheless, Fox News knew about this all this time. This wasn't news to them. So why suddenly did they dump him?
Well, there's several reasons, and we can go down them. First of all, when the New York Times story ran, as you say, Michael, perception was, hey, you're guilty of this. Everybody believes you're guilty of this now because you did pay these people. And so there was a big campaign against the advertisers of The O'Reilly Factor, which is a primetime news show that, of course, for 20 years, Bill O'Reilly made his name on. So advertisers were fleeing the show because, you know, of this campaign highlighting what O'Reilly has said and done over the past, 20 years.
Right. You can sexually harass women. You can be sued. You can pay them out. Fox News can pay out millions of dollars. You just have to keep making them money. And if you're not making them money, they are not going to stand by you. He made his show grossed $450 million over the last 3 years, 2014, 2015, and 2016, a total of $450 million. Big business will look the other way when you're bringing in that kind of coin. But when advertisers are fleeing and suddenly you look like Glenn Beck, you may still have the ratings, but they don't care. If they're not going to make money on you, you're going to hurt their whole brand. And Fox News Channel is hugely important to 21st Century Fox. I mean, this is a big change for them. It's a more than $2 billion revenue each year, $2.6 billion last year. That was an election year, $2.3 billion the year before. It's the most profitable basic cable channel after ESPN. And there is a lot of money at stake here.
To give you some sense as to how important Fox News is to 21st Century Fox at this point in time, Fox News accounts for roughly between 27 and 29% of 21st Century Fox's earnings. And of that, last year, Bill O'Reilly accounted for 19% of Fox News's earnings. So basically, he was he was responsible for 19% of the 29% of 21st Century Fox's revenue.
Yeah, that's getting confusing. He's a big player, and the money he pulls in his own, $150 million a year, that's just what he pulls in directly.
Correct.
Kicks off their prime time. There's 9 o'clock and 10 o'clock. There's Sean Hannity. He's the Cosby Show at 8 o'clock. There's a bad comparison. He's the Cosby Show at 8 o'clock, setting up your entire Thursday night lineup. He is, you know, the Big Bang Theory. That sets up your entire evening. Those other shows work, and in part it's because of the huge lead-in they get. So he's hugely important, not just because of that. But they have other money to be making, right? So now they've got this Sky deal in the UK. I think this was a key reason. Fox has been trying for years to merge with Sky. They want to buy Sky. They made a deal in December for $14 billion to take over this satellite pay TV business.
Which they already own. They already own like
49% of it. Yeah. They own 40% of it. Now they want all of it.
Right.
And it has to be approved in the UK. And if your business has sexual harassment problems, your company has a history, that can block approval. And that is a serious problem for them. So that's one reason why they may have said, we need to pull the trigger on this now, or we're going to screw over this big deal we got going. And that merger approval is being held up because Theresa May called snap elections in the UK to get approval for Brexit.
Also, you could kind of point to, and there was an article in the New York Times about this, about how the sons, Lachlan Murdoch, James Murdoch, are taking over for their father, Rupert Murdoch, who, of course, everybody knows is the big media mogul. It's a family-owned business. James and Lachlan are taking it over. And all of this between Roger Ailes' alleged sexual harassment and...
Not alleged.
Well, that was never...
You don't get fired for alleged.
Well, yeah,
you have multiple windows. You've got 10 women coming forward, big, fat, powerful, famous women who have nothing to benefit. It's not alleged anymore.
Well, I guess they settled that case with Gretchen
Carlson.
Yeah,
they paid Gretchen Carlson money, millions of dollars.
So, yeah, so maybe it's no longer alleged.
He's an official pig.
You can own the T-shirt.
We're not going to be sued. We don't have to dance around it. The guy clearly for decades asked for sex in exchange for, you know, favors, hit on women who were, you know, secretaries, people who were powerless, people who wanted to advance their career, made it clear, you be nice to me, I'll be nice to you. He's a pig.
Roger Ailes, Bill O'Reilly, same boat, so to speak. And it was making them look bad. It was making the Fox brand look bad. And so now that James and Lachlan are in charge, they're coming in and saying, we've got to, straighten the ship out here. We're losing talent like Megyn Kelly. So, you know, this is not looking good, not only internally, but externally as well.
Right. Well, they're just a different generation. They don't think it's fine to look the other way while some cigar chomping jerk hits on women. They're like, no, I don't want to be around that.
Do men still chomp cigars?
When they're sexually harassing women, yes, they do.
I didn't know that was a prerequisite.
Anyone who picks up Bill Clinton, by the way, he would not get the nomination today if he was running for president with the history that he had. It's
probably
a different era. It's only 30 years. But, you know, 25 years. But yeah, you know what? Thank goodness we're in a slightly smarter, better world these days. But yeah, you know, you looked at an article I sent you that had the picture of the Fox News team and how much money they made Fox in 2016. And you said, by the way, two of those six people aren't there anymore. Bill O'Reilly and Megyn Kelly. They must be really kicking themselves for having booted Roger Ailes but kept Bill O'Reilly and thus lost their future, which was Megyn Kelly.
Yeah, they've lost a good four anchors. I think Greta Van Susteren was on that. Was Greta Van Susteren on Fox News? I think she was.
Yes, she was.
They also lost Gretchen Carlson, of course. So they've lost a lot of people.
Yeah, they absolutely. And now those people have gone elsewhere. NBC made some information clear that this summer in June is when Megyn Kelly's show will go up on Sunday nights opposite 60 Minutes. That is a very tough battle. 60 Minutes will be in reruns, but nonetheless, that has been a legend for decades, decades and decades and decades. Very hard to go up against 60 Minutes, which just won Sunday night, by the way, the number one rated show on all of Sunday. So that's a high task for Megyn Kelly to fill. But she's got the same Dateline producers backing her. She may bring some people over from Fox News who worked on her there. But, You know, it's a whole new ball game. And she's going to be doing a Today Show Hour. It will be branded the Today Show. Whether it airs at 9 or 10 a.m., they don't know. But that's a you know, a lot of heavy lifting for her to do.
Well, between Bill Cosby, Billy Bush, and Bill O'Reilly, you are not, if your name is Bill, you better look out.
That's right. And over at Fox News, of course, that means a changing of the chairs. Tucker Carlson will take on 8 o'clock. The Five, their daytime chat show with, you know, about news. That whole team will move to primetime at 9 p.m. I think that was a good call. That's their strongest brand that they have outside of primetime. And Sean Hannity stays fixed at 10 o'clock. The question is Tucker Carlson, who did much better than we thought out of the bat with Bill O'Reilly as a lead-in, is he just a time slot hit? And that's not to be downplayed. A time slot hit is all right. The Cosby Show is on at 8. Cheers is on at 9. You come between them, people are just going to keep watching, and you'll probably have very good ratings. You know what? Lots of shows can't be time slot hits. They just, nobody wants to watch them, period. So that's nothing to be dismissed as unimportant. But it's different being a time slot hit than standing on your own, much less anchoring an entire night. And that's what Tucker Carlson has to do. Clearly, the ratings will be lower. How much lower, we don't know.
Well, and I guess if you want an example of a time slot hit, Anderson Cooper.
Yeah, exactly.
So with that said, you know, when this news broke, certainly I thought about what we had said recently on the show. But I also wondered, gee, this is a person who has, Bill O'Reilly, that is, he has a publishing empire, so to speak. And I thought, well, gee, I can't wait to talk to Michael next week and hear what he has to say about all of these books that Bill O'Reilly publishes. They're all not all nonfiction, but many of them are nonfiction. And, you know, what do you think is going to happen? Henry Holt is his publisher. What's going to happen?
Well, people probably are aware of the killing of series, the killing of, you know, Hitler, the killing of Kennedy, the killing of Reagan, the killing of America, the killing of Patton. You know, he has a long running series of not the killing of Jesus, the long running series of nonfiction books about famous historical figures that he has co-written with another author. Huge platform of Fox News to promote it, which he doesn't have anymore. But You really can't ignore how big these are. He's probably the most successful nonfiction author around for the past 5 or 10 years. More than David McCullough, more than every single one of these books has sold more than 1 million copies. And that is a lot. I know you get used to Harry Potter numbers, but you can sell 1 million copies of a book every year, year in and year out. That is really successful and important. And that is a serious moneymaker. The headlines, when people realized, hey, what about his books? Because he's got a new one coming out in September, by the way. We don't know what it's about, but it's another in the Killing of series, we believe. They all went to Henry Holt and said, what do you say? And Henry Holt gave the response, and all the headlines said, they stand by Bill O'Reilly. What they actually said was, quote, our plans have not changed, end quote. Leave us alone. Go away. Don't talk about it.
I think the book title was just announced, The Killing of My Career.
Very nice. Yeah, so they said, our plans have not changed is not exactly a ringing endorsement. The book world is often very liberal, though there are multiple imprints at different big publishers to publish conservative books. These are not conservative in that sense where they're talking about politics and current events, but there are a number of labels out there that cater to those authors and build up a brand to build up an audience. They obviously don't want to think about this. They don't want to talk about it. Their employees may not be happy having been in business with Bill O'Reilly all this time, but they've been making a lot of money. However, I think books are a little different, don't you?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's harder to mount a social media campaign against a publisher, although it worked with Milo Yiannopoulos. You know, there was a big boycott. I can't remember who it was, which publishing company, but they did.
It's Simon & Schuster, but I shouldn't say that because I'm not sure.
Okay, well, that said, there was a campaign against the publisher and his book was pulled.
That's true. He was an unknown author. But yeah, people don't say, oh, I'm not going to buy any books by Henry Holt. You know, they rarely recognize one book. Each book stands alone. And that's also why it's a little different for them. He's not an employee. He doesn't have a work environment at Henry Holt. Bill O'Reilly is not coming into the office every day. They're not responsible for him. They obviously don't like or approve of him sexually harassing women, but that's not a thing that they're having to deal with because he doesn't come into their office every day. And of course, books don't have ads, so there are no advertisers to flee. Their employees, I bet, are not happy. Other authors at Henry Holt are probably not happy. But these books are not about politics. They're not about current events. They're not about the issues of the day and Bill O'Reilly bloviating or talking about them. They're about Patton and Hitler and Kennedy. So they kind of don't have that lightning rod feel to them. My expectation is that they'll come out with the next book. It may do just as well as always, and that they'll hopefully see this as different, and that, hey, yes, the guy's paid his price. We don't think necessarily he has to stop, you know, ever doing anything ever again. And these books are different. They don't apply. And I think that's perhaps a reasonable argument.
Although it should be noted that Bill O'Reilly did lose all of the advertisers in his books. So
I don't get that joke.
It's not a joke. It is a joke.
Yeah. It is a joke. Okay. Yeah. So his career at TV is dead.
I see what you're doing there, because I think you're moving us along into our obituary section.
Yeah, it's a very sad one this week. Everybody knows Happy Days. Aaron Moran, who played Joni on Happy Days and Joni Loves Chachi, died at 56. I vaguely realized that she'd had not great post-Happy Days career, not a successful or happy person. It was very sad to see some of the quotes and tweets and comments from her co-stars on the show, where they clearly were indicating that she'd had a troubled, you know, not happy life. And they're like, oh, now you're at rest, thank goodness, after so many struggles and that sort of thing. So I don't know her life, but apparently she died of cancer, stage 4 cancer. I know she'd been bankrupt at some point. So, you know, it's very sad. You know, early success like that can be really hard to deal with.
Well, then there's Sandy Gallen, who was so successful that he decided, hey, I'm going to quit what I'm successful at and go and do something completely different. He died at the age of 76. If that name sounds just vaguely familiar, you're not quite sure where you may have heard it before. Well, he was a Hollywood agent and manager who helped launch and guide the careers of Dolly Parton. And he worked with Michael Jackson, and certainly the latter, through those scandal years, through the 90s. He died, as I mentioned, at the age of 76.
Yeah, he worked with Cher, Neil Diamond, Barbara Streisand. He worked with everybody. He made some movies like Father of the Bride. And then he walked away from his career and said, enough of this. I'm going to go into real estate.
Well, yeah, I mean, at first he said enough of this. He didn't know what he was going to do. But then he wound up working in real estate and being just as successful, if not more so, doing that.
I don't know about more so, but yeah, he certainly was happy. And he said that the nice thing about working on homes was that the houses don't talk back.
Yeah, I think that was in an interview that he gave to Architectural Digest. And finally, we have J.C. Spink, who was a manager and producer of movies like The Hangover, and he died at the age of 45. He was found dead. Nobody knows why. More than likely, it was not drug-related, but there's no speculation as to why. He produced movies with his partner, Chris Bender, for the last 20 years. I met him in 1996, 97, and he was incredibly nice. And he and Chris Bender, they worked out of a house that they were sharing in West Hollywood. And they worked their way up at Zide Perry, a production company that produced, American Pie would be one of their films. Mm-hmm. And they produced a lot of movies. They represented a lot of screenwriters. And he was just generally known as a really good guy.
And 45 is awfully young.
Yes.
But as I recall seeing a photo, he did look like he was very overweight. So we're imagining perhaps it was health issues.
Yeah. And look, I don't want to speculate, but yes, that is pretty much what one might think.
What's more of a nice speculation? Because you're saying, yeah, it's not foul play and it's not suicide and it's not drugs. It's probably, sadly and unfortunately, health issues.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, sorry about that. But what a fun name for a company. Bender Spink.
Yeah, it was the combination of their two names, and I haven't seen Chris Bender in a while, and hadn't seen J.C. Spink in years, but I certainly, if you kind of read their Facebook pages this week and what was going on Facebook surrounding this, you could tell that one, they were of a certain age because everybody who knew them was on Facebook with them, but that they're genuinely liked.
Yeah,
and we're genuinely liked, especially when you subscribe to us in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher. You don't have to go on Facebook and tell us that you like us. Just subscribe to us and rate and review us in any one of those podcast aggregators. Although if you do want to like us on Facebook, go to Facebook and search for Showbiz Sandbox. Our page should come up and you can like us there. Or you can follow us on Twitter. @ Showbiz Sandbox is the, you know, username to look up, and up our account should come. follow us. You can also email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find...
We have a website?
We have a website, yes. And
oh,
yes,
wow.
I know it should have a donate button on it. I'm working on it. Now, that said, links to all of the stories that we've discussed on today's episode can be found on that website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. And every week, Michael Giltz has a new and exciting website. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's freetibet.org, and we just got banned in China.
I think we were already banned in China, I'm sure, for something.
Really?
I'm kidding.
That's awesome. I hope so.
Well,
I love China. I want to be heard in there, but that would be kind of cool to be banned.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry over here or read his coverage at freetibet.com, why not head on over to the Huffington Post or michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. And don't forget to check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.